You are listening to a sermon by Sven Eriksson, recorded on Sunday, March 6, 2011, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Thank you, Carl. And good morning.
Good morning.
I must confess at the start that this is a little unusual for me to be this side of the pulpit. I've been enjoying being on that side for a couple of years now, and so it's an adventure to get back on the horse and to ride again. This text and these passages in the story, we must admit at the beginning, are well beyond our ability to analyze or grasp. And I think they raise to us 21st century people more questions than answers. But that takes none of their authority or wonder or impact from the text and from us. Transfiguration Sunday is a day that hinges the season of Epiphany that we've just finished and the season of Lent that we're about to enter. It's the celebration of a great transition in the life of Jesus and the life of his disciples from 3 years of ministry and work now to about a week of trial, suffering, passion, and death. In the evangelical church, this story, I think, has been underobserved. In the mainline churches, I think my impression is probably underbelieved. Is it that we become intellectually mulish at visions and strange otherworldly lights and luminous clouds? All of this is definitely out of the frame of our common reference. The observant word here is mystery. By saying mystery, we say something is beyond our rational comprehension and analysis. It is bigger and beyond the limitations of our words, traditions, and constructs. The Bible is chock full of mystery, and if we were to hold our rational noses every time we encounter mystery in the Bible, we would get mightily sore noses and very thin faith as a product. Peter's memory of transfiguration is found in 2 Peter 1, and I would like to read it for us again. Peter writes these words as if to cynical detractors that are there in the community that he's writing to. For we did not follow the cleverly devised myths when we made known to you the power and the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we have become eyewitnesses of his majesty. For he received honor and glory from God the Father when that voice was conveyed to him by the majestic glory, saying, "This is my Son, my beloved, with whom I am well pleased." Let's reflect on this strange and wonderful event. Why did Jesus lead the disciples into this experience? Luke tells us that Jesus went to the mountain to pray, and he wanted, apparently with him, the support of whose three most close companions, Peter, James, and John. Interestingly, he did the same thing later in the Garden of Gethsemane, as you will recall, when he had these three go with him into the garden. And interestingly, there, like here, they fell asleep, which is kind of an interesting sidebar on the disciples. I believe Jesus' agenda was to prepare himself for what lay ahead and to pray. He also, I think, wanted to prepare his disciples for what lay ahead for them. What happened on that day in the mountain became for them eventually a beacon for dark days ahead. How they responded to immediately was something else again. I mean, they were confused and dazed, and they didn't make much sense of it. The Holy Mountain, as the text refers, according to scholars, is either Mount Tabor or Mount Horeb, both notable mountains in the history of Israel. But no one knows quite for sure where. But the point is that it happened somewhere in some rocky mountain slope. As we read the Bible, we see that when God's presence touches down, so to speak, these events occur at particular places and in particular times. I think that's important to notice. There is a concrete particularity to divine revelations. They happen to particular individuals, like Noah, Abram and Sarah, Jacob, Moses, Mary. The list could be very long. And all of these occurred at particular geographical locations. Mount Sinai, and many places. I had the opportunity of going to Israel and being a kind of a pilgrim and checking out some of these places that the Bible refers to. God has a heart for intimacy with individuals. And we individuals are found at places and in times. And so God enters our space. If truth be told, if we're to find the freedom and the courage to tell our stories, we could also tell about holy mountain experiences that we've had. Times of crisis when God's presence has given us courage. Experiences of guidance, dreams offering spiritual insight. Extraordinary answers to prayer. Even visions and strange experiences. As biblical people, this shouldn't surprise us. Because how can we read the Bible seriously without realizing that there's something afoot here in all of this that is so much bigger than our comprehensions or grasp? Do we tell these stories to each other? Should we? If I was to stop this sermon halfway through and open it up and say, all right, let's talk about the extraordinary experiences that we've had. I bet you we'd find lots of interesting stories. What do we do with stories from outside our frame of reference? My understanding of this has been helpfully informed by a conversation I had with Jim here a couple of weeks ago about this topic. We tend to expect a certain constancy in our environment. An even attempt to ward off variations from the state of affairs that we normally experience. Because expectations mold perception, we dismiss the unexpected. That's very common. For example, a simple man, a hayseed from the hills, whose experience of large mammals had been limited to horses and cows, saw a giraffe one day. And he declared, "There ain't no such animal." He was experiencing denial. There was nothing in his background that made possible the appearance of a giraffe. There ain't no such animal. Are we in denial of transcendence in how we live and how we think and how we go about our lives in this present scientifically shaped world with our closed systems of understanding reality and our small paradigms, as it turns out, of including reality? How did the disciples respond to the transfiguration? At the end of the day, they did believe what they had seen. And we have the stories that we have read to give evidence to that. It's notable that by law at this time, the veracity of an event could be established with three witnesses. And here we find the three disciples with Jesus, and here we have the stories in our Bible. Imagine with me what was going on inside Peter on that day. Our Matthew text begins with a time reference that begins 6 days later. And Jesus led them up the mountain. 6 days earlier, as we look back into chapter 16, it appears that everything was coming together for Jesus and the disciples. At a place called Caesarea Philippi, Jesus had posed the question, "Who do you say that I am?" This was the sort of climactic phase of his teaching the disciples his ways. It was a white-hot question for them that cut deeply into 3 years of experience and their encounter with Jesus. And Peter had replied, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And then Jesus affirmed and blessed Peter because he had got it. And Jesus named him Rock, one to become foundational to the church. As you remember how the story unfolded, then Jesus began to reveal to them what lay ahead, just beyond this mountain, that he would be killed, and that on the third day he would rise again. Peter then began to rebuke Jesus. No way, he said, was he going to die. And then Jesus accused Peter, the rock, of becoming a stumbling stone and a Satan. That was 1 week ago, before this happened. Peter had been on a high and then fell so low that he could hardly recover. He had what we might call a meltdown. And now, as they began their climb, Peter must have been in a state of suspended confusion, of brokenness, all the more broken for how high he had been and how high he had soared. The Luke account mentions two things not in the Matthew text: that he went up to the mountain to pray, and that the disciples were very, very sleepy. So as Jesus goes ahead to pray on his own, they find comfort, comfortable rocks to lean against, and then they fall asleep. And then, as we see in the story, they were awakened to a wonder. And Luke tells us, while Jesus was praying, the appearance of his face changed, and his clothes became dazzling white. Matthew puts it, he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun. Two wonders impressed upon their memories. One was the sudden appearance and then disappearance of Moses and Elijah. And then Peter's always impulsive, always interesting, does not disappoint. He proposes the setting up of three tents for Jesus and his heavenly guests. Luke explains, as Carl has mentioned already, that Peter didn't know what he was saying. He was apparently in some kind of delirium at this point. The other wonder was the voice from the cloud. And while they were still speaking, suddenly a bright cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud a voice said, "This is my son, my beloved, listen to him." And then when the disciples heard this, they fell to the ground and were overcome by fear. Then a wonderful moment happened. A moment that I hadn't really noticed before I began to do this work for this sermon. There are times when all we really need is to be touched. We are lost, confused, and we need someone with care to touch us, to bring us back. And this is exactly what Jesus did. He simply reached down and touched Peter, James, and John and said, "Do not be afraid." Here we have this extraordinary care and grace coming from Jesus, who had just been declared as the Son of God. Here are the disciples flat on their face in abject confusion. Jesus touched them and said, "Be not afraid." And then they looked around and mercifully and saw no one except Jesus. It had been enough for them. Too much more might have killed them. Peter, James, and John had encountered glory. Glory is a very important word here in this story. What do we mean by this word? Glory is a quality of radiance. It's the character, the essence, the beauty of something or someone shining through and radiating. So I thought about this word, I thought about stained glass windows and some of the most beautiful ones in Europe and big cathedrals. And then, of course, there are these as well. The light shines through. And we see a radiance of the quality of the colors of the glass. This is what glory is about, a kind of shining through. This morning as we drove from Ladner to Vancouver, we saw the North Shore Mountains in their splendor. And an apt word for them would be glorious, because the light and the sun was reflecting and showing how beautiful the mountains are. The glory of the mountains was being expressed. In the mornings, I go for walks in Ladner Marsh every morning early. And yesterday when I did this, there was glory in that experience. There was a gloriousness about the birds early in the morning, the little tiny ones trilling, the red-headed blackbirds piping, and the reedy kind of piping sound, and the robins, they all made a glorious effect audibly for me. On that mountain slope, Peter, James, and John found themselves in the presence of God's glory, in the unfiltered shining out of, the radiating from Jesus and who he was. God-hungry people throughout biblical history and church history have been known to climb mountains and to fast in deserts. Think of Moses, Elijah, John the Baptist, Jesus, the early church fathers and mothers that went off into the desert. These kinds of retreats and these kinds of impulses are to wake us up, to shake us out of sleepy stupors. There are times when we are led up mountains to be confronted with glory. Sometimes it's a soft, gentle, merciful glory. Sometimes it's a terrible, majestic glory that knocks us right off our feet. Why do we need this? Why do we need glory? I believe because we were created with a capacity and a need for glory. We were created in the image and likeness of God. So says Genesis 1:26. And the Bible goes on to explain and to illustrate we have fallen short of the glory of God. Hence, we are profoundly ambivalent about glory. We are drawn to glory. We even see this in our least noble selves. How we have a tendency to grab hold of the good things of life and to squeeze them for all we're worth. We do this with our money, with sex, with power. These are the big three. And what is this all about? I think it's out of our need for glory, out of our hunger for the holy. But these are baskets too small for glory. And in the end, they disappoint. What conclusions can we draw from this mysterious text and this demanding and difficult passage in Scripture? That for Peter, James, and John, this mountaintop experience was a gift. Not in the sense that they wanted to encounter glory in this way. I don't think they really did. Nevertheless, they were invited in. What happened was entirely God's doing. It was the giving of God's fierce grace. And it's one example of the fact that all of life is gift and grace. But here it takes a focus that's very fierce and very bright. Perhaps our struggle with this story is just there. They were not prompted to do anything. Peter, James, and John were not. They were simply to show up. We tend to be more comfortable with texts and stories that are less mystical, where it becomes clear, okay, now what do we do? And so the preacher lines out, okay, these are the conclusions, we must go out and do these things. Like Peter, we want to build something, we want to do something, something that we can manage and something that we can control. In this story, they were simply to show up and to encounter something of God's glory. What difference does it make to encounter glory? In the light of God's glory, we begin to recognize and let go of lesser things, good things, yet such glories that can develop idol-like powers over us. In light of glory, we are changed. We're transfigured, to use the word. There's a metamorphosis that the Spirit develops in us. In the light of glory, we encounter mystery, and we become silent in awe, and we're enabled to worship. In conclusion, let me leave you with some texts that call us to openness to glory. In Colossians, Paul writes, "Pray diligently, stay alert, with your eyes wide open in gratitude." And in Colossians, or rather in Corinthians, "And we with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory, are being transformed into his likeness with ever increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit."